For centuries, Jews have been persecuted, brutalized by anti-Semitism, and violently thrown out of country after country. The Jewish people were violently expelled from Jerusalem by the Roman Empire. The Jewish people were violently expelled from Alexandria. The Jewish people were violently expelled from France. The Jewish people were violently expelled from England. The Jewish people were violently expelled from Spain. The Jewish people were violently expelled from Switzerland. The Jewish people were violently expelled from Portugal. The Jewish people were violently expelled from countries all throughout Europe. The Jewish people were violently expelled from the Middle East. The Jewish people were systematically murdered by the Nazi regime. The Jewish people were violently attacked by Hamas on October 7th, resulting in the largest loss of Jewish life in a single day since the Holocaust. So we are here, more than 100,000 people strong, to unequivocally declare never again.
Welcome back. Another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Dr. Kevin McDonald on the show. Dr. McDonald is a professor emeritus of psychology at CSU Long Beach, a prolific author. He has written many books. I guess you call it a trilogy, The Culture of Critique, Separation and Discontents, and People That Should Dwell Alone. Is that a fair characterization of that of those series of books?
Yeah, those are my three books on Judaism.
Yes. Yeah, so the, on the Jewish question, so to speak. Yeah. And of course, you also have a more recent one is Individualism and the Western Liberal Tradition, which focuses on, I guess, European peoples, right, and their attitudes. And
yeah, but it also, especially the last couple chapters, does deal with, last three chapters deal with Jewish issues as well and the interaction with Europeans.
Okay, yeah, so yeah, how they interact, of course, the dialectic there.
Yeah, it's a huge, hugely important, actually.
Yeah, we're seeing, of course, that today and any number of issues, particularly foreign policy. You're also a contributor to the Occidental Observer, correct?
That's correct, and I also edit the Occidental Quarterly, which, you know, is a quarterly magazine, sort of academic magazine, longer articles, that sort of thing. And then Occidental Observer is more blog-like. Mm-hmm. Well, some long articles, like there's one today, but it's a translation from a German author in 1937. It's really interesting, very interesting, actually.
Well, again, I guess these books are never topical. Are never not topical. They're very topical, yeah. Given the current situation, rather, both home and abroad. Of course, we see how foreign policy affects the domestic front, especially when the same people who are controlling and apparently have, at least have an inordinate influence on foreign policy, also have an equal inordinate influence on the domestic front, particularly the Middle East, Gaza, the October 7th attack, and of course the Israeli response and their bombing of Gaza, the ongoing carnage there, and the reaction, particularly of the political class, the mainstream media, has sort of, I think, revealed to many who may not been aware as much of just how pervasive Jewish power is. I think in many respects they're exposed. And you wrote a couple of articles covering this, and we can talk about this. I'll let you go talk about it. The first article was Why Are Jews So Influential? And the second article, I guess it was a follow-up, is Will the Gaza War Threaten Jewish Power in the U.S. and Their Status as Occupying the Moral Ground? So I'll let you take it from there, Dr. McDonald. Why are you so influential?
Well, you know, I'm a psychologist, and also, you know, I read a lot of Jewish history. So it's a sort of a combination that I get, make several, it's divided into several sections. And first of which, yeah, that, you know, the Jewish, the traits of Jews, you know, overall, not, again, we don't apply them to every Jew, but we say that that's sort of a central tendency that affects their group behavior. The first and foremost is ethnocentrism. Jews are able to cooperate in highly organized, very cohesive groups. They're very effective. They're also, of course, highly intelligent. I mean, their average IQ, according to Richard Lynn, is 111, and there's a bias towards verbal IQ, which is very important for upper mobility, very important for occupations like, you know, writing, fiction, but also nonfiction, and also for things like law. You know, the whole legal profession is very influenced by Jews. Journalism, the media, all these are important areas that Jews are very good at. And but it's also, intelligence is also useful to attaining wealth, and wealth is, Jewish groups are one of the, I would say they are the most, they are the wealthiest Americans. 35% of the Fortune 500 company list of billionaires are Jewish. Well, that's critically important because Jews are often, as I say, very ethnocentric, and they contribute to Jewish causes. They fund a huge Jewish infrastructure. You know, the Israel lobby, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, the Jewish Institute of National Security Affairs, the Zionist Organization of America, the ADL, all these groups are massively funded. Like the ADL is $238 million of assets. They get like $62 million a year in donations. You know, just think of how much money, you know, white nationalists, people who take white identity seriously and want to preserve sort of a white America. You know, we don't have any money compared to that. They are massively funded. And we can see that actually in the Gaza war thing, because these Jewish billionaires are threatening to blacklist students who protest on behalf of the Palestinians. They're threatening to cut off universities if they're not vigilant enough going after the students who protest for Palestine.
That's just a raw exercise of power there, right? Financial.
Yeah, I think that's the root, really, of all their power. I mean, that's why Jews own so much in terms of the, it's not just media contribution, but it's also media ownership. You know, back when I was growing up, all five of the Hollywood students, wherever they were owned by Jews, all three television networks. And that's a huge influence because these people are not just, you know, they don't have, it's not as if they don't have biases and that sort of thing. I mean, my whole book, The Culture Critique, shows Jewish activism on behalf of certain issues. I mean, one of which is pro-immigration, pro-multiculturalism, pro-Israel. They were very essential in the civil rights movement. And not that I don't really oppose civil rights. I think that's fine. But it has morphed now into this incredible Black Lives Matter, hatred of white people, the whole gender craziness. So it's a huge influence. It's transformed the country. And I'm just going over it. I mean, I wrote a review of Henry Ford's series, The International Jew, which he published in like 1920 and 1921, around there. And even at that time, I mean, this was when Jews had first immigrated to America in large numbers. But they were already having a big influence, and especially on Christianity in the public square. They didn't like school prayers. They didn't want, Jesus statues, you know, how, you know, Christmas scenes in public, that sort of thing, or Christmas carols in school.
Now, these were our cultural expressions, traditions, things that existed prior to their arrival to the shores of America in the 19th century. So they come in as newcomers and then act offended by what they see and presume the right to change and upend everything.
Yeah, so one of the traits that I talk about is aggression, because these people, even though they're a very small percentage of the American population, have been very aggressive against the traditional American majority, the white people. And Christianity is one part of it. Immigration is another part of it. I mean, they have wanted to make America multicultural because Jews feel safer in a multicultural society. From a standpoint of Jews, what happened in the 1930s in Germany cannot be repeated, where you had a pretty homogeneous society apart from Jews, and they ganged up on the Jews. And so that is something that they don't want to do. They still feel that we could turn on them at any moment if we had the power to do it. So the whole point of immigration policy from the Jewish point of view has been to decrease the power of white Americans. And that's what they've accomplished. I mean, now it's quite often that white people, even if they vote for a candidate, you know, the majority, the candidate won't win because you've got, you know, massive numbers now of non-whites in the country, and they tend to vote for the left. White people tend to vote Republican, but, you know, everybody knows the Republican Party's not great and by any means. And they are just about as equally influenced by Jewish money and media control and that sort of thing as the Democrat Party. So it's wall-to-wall kind of pressure in certain directions that has been going on for well over a century, but, you know, really increasing a lot after World War II. In the 1930s, you had anti-Semitism fairly common. You had Henry Ford in the 1920s, and then in the 1930s, you had people like Father Charles Coughlin, had a massive radio show, extremely popular, and it was a, like, Super Bowl level audience. I mean, it was like 30 million listeners out of a population of 130 million. I mean, imagine that. Mm-hmm. Who gets that kind of audience now? And but he was shut down, and that was Jewish activism. They got
that dwarfs Rush Limbaugh at his peak.
yeah, really. And
radio mattered a lot more back then too, of course.
Yeah, that was the only medium, really.
Yeah.
I mean,
electronic.
You didn't have TV. And so that was the ball game. Well, you had newspapers, and that was very important. But even then, if you look at newspapers, you know, a lot of the very important newspapers in the big cities were owned by Jews, like the New York Times, the Philadelphia Inquirer, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and a whole lot of others. And so the Jews were, you know, from a long time ago, in the middle of the 19th century, were consciously aware that the media was important. And there's a classic book that I reviewed on anti-Semitism in the 19th century. And the writer talks about a conference where Jews were saying, we have to have influence in the media. And so an awful lot of the media was bought up by Jews.
So you have a concerted effort. You have a concerted, yes. Sorry to interrupt. You have a concerted effort.
Yeah.
Jewish individuals, Jewish organizations saying they have to work to control and dominate the media. But if you point out that Jews are controlling and dominating the media, they accuse you of anti-Semitism.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. They will accuse you of that. And you know, this, and anything that Jews don't like is going to be called anti-Semitism. It doesn't matter how true it is or whatever. That's just what their activism involves. And we can all see, I mean, you can see what all of the examples I mentioned are what you call top down. I mean, Jews are an elite, and they've always been an elite and throughout their history. They've made alliances with other elites, like in the Middle Ages and the period before the French Revolution, English Civil War, all that. They, you know, when the aristocracy was very important, Jews made alliances with aristocrats, kings, and feudal lords, and all that. In other words, it's always a top-down kind of thing. They don't trust the popular opinion, and oftentimes these relationships were exploitative. They would be paid by the king to collect taxes, and Jews collecting taxes from non-Jews. You can just imagine they're going to take what they can from these people, and so these aristocrats would often employ Jews because they were unscrupulous towards non-Jews, and a very common theme. And but it's what we see now, really. I mean, Jewish activism is directed top down. It's controlled from the top media, the top universities, billionaires. Like I said, going after students at Harvard now with protests on behalf of the Palestinians, refusing to give money. These are billionaires who have contributed huge amounts of money in the past, and they're saying we're not going to contribute anymore. Like at University of Pennsylvania, which is an Ivy League school, this billionaire, Mark Rowan, has said he wants to fire the president of the university and the head of the board of directors because they weren't quick enough in condemning the Hamas thing. And, now it's an olive in both cases, Harvard and Penn and everywhere. These universities are falling into line and they're establishing programs to deal with quote anti-Semitism, and it's true. I mean, that I think the Gaza war is waking a lot of people up. The Jews are not as nice people as you might have thought. I mean, the whole say the involvement of Jews in the Bolshevik Revolution in the 1920s, after 1917, huge involvement. And this was a time of mass murder. 20 million Russians apparently were murdered. And Jews were often the executioners. They were deeply involved in the secret police and all that. And Jewish organizations in America were often pro-communist, really until it started to get really unfashionable after World War II. And then the Jewish organizations tried to clamp down on communists.
Well, it's kind of funny because during the McCarthy period, they tried to. One thing that was exposed was a lot of the communist spies, particularly like the Green Glass and the Rosenbergs, they're all Jewish. Yeah. That's when the Jews started talking about blacklisting and McCarthyism to cover up the Jewish, the Jewish role in all that espionage.
Yeah. And so that's a big chip on their shoulder now. I mean, the whole blacklisting period, you'll have movies about McCarthy.
Still make movies about it, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And they're always negative about McCarthy. And, they act as if they believe in free speech because, they wanted this blacklist. People had to disavow communism and all that. Nowadays, who's really behind the campaigns to end free speech? Jewish activism. I mean, they love censorship. You know, the ADL has been deeply involved in censoring on YouTube, on Twitter, X, including myself, by the way. I've been bounced off of there. And they never told me what tweet it was or anything. No negotiation, no appeal, but they don't respond to it. And
didn't they coin hate speech, the term?
Yeah, and they still do that. But I think a lot of people are realizing that what they are doing, what you see in the Jewish media is, Hamas is evil. They came and they attacked Jews and they killed some Jews, like 1,200 or 1,400 or something, and took some hostages. And that's the end of the story. You wouldn't have any idea about the oppression of the Palestinians. I mean, you can imagine living in Gaza for the last 17 years, whatever, since Israel left, Hamas won. They've been blockading it, and so that they get the bare essentials of food. They can't go in and out freely, and so it's absolute oppression. And then in the West Bank, they've taken over more and more territory. I mean, these have these maps of what the West Bank was like in 1948 after the Jews established Israel and all Palestinians. Since the 1967 war, they have settled more and more. There's hundreds of thousands of settlers over there now, and they ain't moving. And the whole idea of a two-state solution, they keep talking about that, the two-state solution. That'll solve the problem. And Israel, goes along with that, but they never come through. And it's a myth. It's just a propaganda at this point to make people feel good. Wow, there's an end in sight. No, there isn't. The only end in sight is complete degradation of the Palestinians. And that is what is happening. And you can see that in Gaza now. I mean, they're just the whole idea that they're trying to. If you type into Google or something, type in Israel, the most moral armory in the world. I mean, that's a slogan that they have. Nobody's going to believe that Israel is the most moral armory. They're bombing everything. They tell people to go into the south, and then they bomb the south. I mean, it's ridiculous. And I really do think that Jewish power, is still being, still there for sure. I mean, you look at Congress and unanimous resolutions in the Senate on Israel. In the House, you got those few Democrats who, the Palestinian Rashida Tlaib and the so-called squat and those people. But they're a small minority. In every election cycle, the ADL pumps millions of dollars to try to get them out of there. I just saw that Ilhan Omar in Minneapolis there's some candidate that is going to oppose her. And I'm sure it's a pro-Israel candidate.
But the irony is that those Ilhan Omar is only in Congress, and so Rashida Tlaib is because of Jewish backed immigration policy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But they are. They're not white and they're not Jewish, and they identify more with the third world, so that's where they're at. They see what's happening in Palestine, and they see Israel. A lot of them see it as extension of Western colonialism. That this is just part of what the British Empire did back in the turn of the 19th century, where they controlled that whole area. And that's sort of where we're at now.
Yeah, it's interesting to see sort of this the breakup of sort of the Zionist leftist Jewish alliance over this, because you have people of color, if you will, upset over the bombing of the Palestinians, who are people of color by what they guess see as white people, the Jews, because Jews don't see themselves as white. Is European, Occidental, Christian. That's the distinction there. It's just we use the term white. Yeah. So it's a general term that's been thrown out because that's easily pathologized in many ways. But it is interesting. You can cite, and you have various and multiple examples of Jews organizing collectively to promote what they see as their interests at the expense of everyone else. But then, if you can organize collectively and engage collectively in politics, whatever, you have to also have to be subject to collective criticism. But any effort of collective criticism is pathologized as anti-Semitism, verging on sort of retrograde Nazism or something.
It's right, absolutely. And when you criticize Jews, you are talking about a group, a collectivity. And you're not talking about all Jews necessarily, and probably not. But what you are talking about, trying to talk about, is where Jewish power is directed, where the money comes from. Certainly you can find some Jews who may even be on our side, but few and far between, and certainly the 99.999% of the money is going to other causes, and many of them against white America. There's never any consideration of what the interests of white people were, what of white Americans, when Jews lobbied for this multi-ethnic immigration, for example. There's never any interest in white America, really, in their pro-Israel lobbying. I mean, it's been about Israel, and Israel has proved over and over again they're not a very good ally. I mean, just now they're they're rejecting Biden's proposals about ceasefire, and they reject or having some kind of pause, and they don't see eye to on the status of Gaza after the war and all that. But there's a lot of examples of that, where American policy has been one thing, and a lot of examples of Jewish spying in America on behalf of Israel. So, you know, it's they don't think of American interests first, although they will say they will, and they've tried to, you know, it's very sophisticated arguments in the mainstream media and big opinion journals and that sort of thing, justifying it all, but it's they're very good at that.
Well, that's the problem with our society, is we're not supposed to think ethnicity matters. We're supposed to have the idea that what matters is, you know, civic creeds or civic
nationalism. Yes, absolutely. That was invented by Jewish intellectuals. You know, yeah. That, yeah. What's his name? I just can't remember, black guy's name, but I have a section out of my chapter on immigration.
The melting pot?
Yeah, the melting pot idea that
Zwingli or something. Zwingli.
Yeah, Americans are have no creed except some kind of citizenship, and there's no ethnic overtones to what America is, and yet that's what America felt about itself. Really, I think really until maybe 1950, 1960, that's. Americans felt, well, yeah, it's a part of European civilization.
If there was never any ethnic idea to America, how was America ever racist then? They contradict themselves, you know? Yeah, it's like, wait a second. But if that were the case, but it is from a standpoint, you know, we have a problem of our government not representing our interests, obviously with Congress. Congress is more concerned with Israel than it is with the welfare of the American people. You can see that in the unanimous votes, what you vote unanimously on, you know, you can't get them to build a wall or maintain infrastructure, but you can get them unanimously to just fork over, you know, billions and billions of dollars in Israeli-backed, you know, wars or Jewish-backed proxy wars like in Ukraine, and destabilize the entire world order for that.
Yeah.
But this might be, you talk about the Israeli spies like Jonathan Pollard. And Jonathan Pollard, of course, was reported to be one of the most damaging spy cases in the history of the United States. He was convicted, sent to prison, sentenced for life. For the moment he was sentenced, even before he was sentenced, the organized Jewish community lobbied for clemency in this case, or get him out. And of course, he eventually was released and then sent to Israel. He flew on Sheldon Adelson's plane, a Jewish oligarch, billionaire backer of the Republican Party, and he was received as a hero in Tel Aviv. By Benjamin Netanyahu. Now, here's the thing. If Israel is pro-American, an ally, how can an American traitor be received as a hero in Israel?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I mean, that's the way it always has been.
Obviously, what matters is the fact that he's Jewish, not that he's American. To Sheldon Adelson and all the Jews that argued for his release and his pardon, what mattered more was the fact he was Jewish, not that he was an American. And you have a problem throughout our government. We've got people in trust in governmental positions who are pursuing narrow Jewish interests or Israeli interests, and they're exploiting their positions in government to do that. This goes way back from the very get-go. We hear about figures like Louis Brandeis, the first Jew appointed to the United States Supreme Court, and we see this as a great moment in American history when we can shed our prejudices and our racism or anti-Semitism and give this man an opportunity to serve his country. But it turns out he was a Zionist agent and using his position, a member of a secret society, to advance narrow Jewish Zionist interests at the expense of the United States. It was the Jews within various governmental positions and also various financial and economic positions publishing that got America into the First World War for Jewish interests, not for America, but for Jewish interests.
Yeah, there was not a well-known story, but yeah, I think it's accurate that Wilson made a deal with the Jews on entering the war on behalf of the Allied powers.
And for what I said,
there wasn't any sentiment in America to enter that war.
No,
same in World War II. I mean, you had this huge isolationist movement. And and Charles Lindbergh and all that. And Jews were certainly pushing that as well. And that was how Lindbergh got in so much trouble.
Well, he spoke the truth. It was a gaffe. It's a traditional gaffe, meaning he spoke the truth.
He spoke the truth. And the truth was that he wasn't saying it was all because of the Jews. I mean, they were just one of the groups.
Yeah, the British.
And it was obvious that was true.
Yeah.
But it didn't matter. It hasn't mattered ever since.
No. But then they take, after the war, they take pride in getting the country into the war. I think it's Rabbi Stephen
who
boasted about that. But wait a second. Lindbergh said that back in 1941. You called him an anti-Semite.
Yeah.
For pointing out the obvious.
Yeah.
Again, today we have well over 450 Jews in various key positions in the Biden administration. We have a Jew attorney general who can't seem to uphold the rule of law. And he's harassing in Catholics for opposing abortion. We have a Jew in control of our borders who's working to undermine the borders. And I think you've alluded to it, but we've seen in this country and in all throughout Europe, Jewish people entrusted in this position, like in Barbara Roche in Great Britain, Shatter in Ireland, these Jewish ministers who work to undermine the borders to bring in outsiders to change the population. It's a pattern we see all over.
Yeah, I'm starting to see that Ireland is going to be majority non-white in 2030. Hard to believe.
Yeah, they have no margin of error in Ireland. They have no margin of error. It's a small country. Same thing with Finland or Sweden and all those countries. And familiar, I think you've written about it, what Barbara Lerner Specter posted doing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a classic. You see that? I see that all the time now.
Yes.
It's gotten around.
I think there's a resurgence of anti-Semitism because at this point in time, Europe has not yet learned how to be multicultural. And I think we're going to be part of the throes of that transformation, which must take place. Europe is not going to be the monolithic societies that they once were in the last century. Jews are going to be at the center of that. It's a huge transformation for Europe to make. They are now going into a multicultural mode, and Jews will be resented because of our leading role. But without that leading role and without that transformation, Europe will not survive.
Here it is. But now this conflict in Gaza, you've talked, what the billionaires are doing at the Ivy League schools. You had a protest in Washington, D.C. yesterday against anti-Semitism. You have the obsequiousness of our political class. And that's something where the political class, whereas I saw a poll, 66% of the American people supported an immediate ceasefire. Only 1% of Congress did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But 100% of the top donors to the Republican Party and Democratic Party are full backers of Israel, if you get my drift.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the thing. I mean, there's every politician, if you're a politician, your whole objective is to get elected. Well, if you stand up to something like that, your career is probably over, unless you're in a really safe district where they don't care about the Jews or something like that. And I think, Ilhan Omar, she's been reelected, even though Jews have been hating on her for a long time. She can do that because she's got a safe, ethnically compatible district and that sort of thing. But, most politicians, if you're a representative or a senator from Iowa, you don't care about Israel, but you better go along with it because if you don't, you're in trouble. You're interested in farm prices and that sort of thing for your constituents. So you just have to...
Your
career is going to be over.
Yeah, if you do kind of speak up about it, sort of a tangential issue, let's say Stephen King, when he talked about immigration, well, they got him out of his seat. They primaried him out of his seat because he wasn't going along with the plan.
Oh, yeah, Stephen King, famously.
Yeah. And that was the former speaker that did that, played the trick on him.
Yeah.
McCarthy. And another just a creature for these interests. And that's the problem is the donor class, which is primarily Jewish, overwhelmingly Jewish, has sort of created this ossified political situation where the American people simply have no representation in government And that's the, I guess the biggest, I guess the primary political problem we're confronted today is the political class just simply does not represent the American people, and the American people effectively have no agency to influence the political class, at least at the national level.
Yeah, I mean, and as we said, you know, ultimately Jewish power comes from money, especially in our society. You know, a democracy is really about the influence of the top institutions. And so that's why Jews are an elite. And my book, The Culture Critique, I talk about Jewish involvement in big universities. I've written some more stuff on that. The intellectual dominance, and but also financial, you know, just the contributions, like 75% probably the Democrat Party, 40% of the Republicans. I mean, 40% is the majority, but you don't ignore 40%.
No.
So you gotta pay attention to it. And the rest of these donors are oftentimes libertarian or something, or you know, vaguely conservative or religious or something, and that's about it.
Yeah, it were different if you had the other 60% were staunchly critical of Jewish power.
Yeah.
I mean, if they were aware of it, meaning this is the idea that the Jews are well organized. You know, it's almost like having a phalanx organized against a mob. The phalanx is always going to win because it's a well organized structure. And that's And of course, the other side is psychologically unable even to think of organizing on lines similar to how the Jews organized, because we're told that's illiberal and racist.
Yeah. I mean, that's been so effective with so many white people. They are just horrified. I saw this little video where they asked white people to say, you know, to move into an area where they felt a lot of guilt or no guilt or little guilt. And, you know, almost all of them went to the very guilty part. And they've been programmed now to hate white culture, white history. And that's just, that's a recipe for death. I mean, the culture can't continue like that.
Well, they take a heck of a lot for granted, don't they? Whether it's the language they speak, the building they're in.
Yeah.
You know, the plumbing they use.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, these are all aspects or artifacts of white European Western culture.
Yeah.
And it just didn't come out of the ether. These things had to be developed over time. And this is a tribute to Western civilization. The fact that some people want to take part, at least get the goodies from it. That's the problem, is a lot of the people that are now invited into the West have no part in it, have no really connection to its creation and maintenance. They just want to take. And we see that in the various riots. We see that even in our own like minority populations with the blacks, with the looting. It's almost second nature. And I mean, that's why they can't maintain a modern civilization without, you know, some sort of stewardship, as we're seeing. Right. You know, we see that all over. You know, it's whether it's South Africa or Jackson, Mississippi, you know.
Yeah. Selma, Alabama, or, you know, Africa. Mm-hmm. Haiti is a classic. I mean, Haiti's completely, it just keeps getting worse.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing they can do is try to get the hell out. But, you know, all these gangs running the place, and it's just...
Well, they still blame it on the fact that the French were there in the 1820s.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a long time ago. I mean, it's getting a little late on that. But yeah, I saw a video, what was it? I forget the guy's name. He's the guy who was doing a lot of stuff. Chris Rufo.
Uh-huh.
And he had done a lot of work for the, I think, the Manhattan Institute, which is a Jewish run outfit, neoconservative, right wing. He did some pretty good work on critical race theory. You know, just the stuff where he's allowed to talk about these things, because he wasn't bringing up the Jewish support for critical race theory. He's going after, you know, the blacks who are promoting it. But he is on some show, I think it was MSNBC, and the host was black, and the host was kind of goading him to saying, is there anything positive about being white? Is there anything to white culture? And Chris Rufo was so intimidated, he couldn't say anything back to him. So I was saying, I don't know, how about the language we're speaking? How about polyphonic music? How about, you know, rule of law? I mean, there's all types of things you could cite. But these people just take all these things for granted, and in the process, they're ruining them, they're trashing them because they can't maintain them because they have no regard for them as the polling shows. Meaning, what we consider, this is the irony of America. We're told that America is a creedal nation, it's a proposition nation, and it doesn't matter what race you are, as long as you buy into the proposition. But if you follow all the polling, the propositions that supposedly define America are only broadly supported by ethnic white Americans.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, Cruz Rufo, I was going to write an article on one of the things he wrote about race. I mean, he was just horrified by the idea of white identity and white interests. He won't go there, even though he was acknowledging there are groups that are important. There are group differences, he even said. But you just can't advocate for white people. And these people have a losing philosophy. Jews would never do that.
Irony is that civil rights activists, black activists, minority groups, people of color groups, those who supposedly advocate for them or are them, they'll cite disparities and inequality as sort of prima facie evidence of racism as opposed to just group differences. Given all things being considered, there are group differences, preferences, and that's going to manifest itself in different levels of achievement as such. Yeah. But we look at Jewish overall overrepresentation, and Jews would just say, well, that's because we're smarter. It has nothing to do with nepotism or favoritism. Yeah. And if you draw that out, if you suggest that it may be nepotism or favoritism, in-group preferences, they'll call you an anti-Semite. It's an anti-Semitic trope. It's a canard, blah, 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 ADL stuff. But wait a second. If overrepresentation is a prima facie evidence for discrimination, racial, ethnic, and it applies to you too, but apparently to them it doesn't. To them, it's always because they have higher IQs.
That's a good point. That's a good point. Yeah. I mean, now, we see all, for black people in America, they've had affirmative action for like 50 years. And you can see some blacks are making piles of money. But you've got this, a large percentage, too large, that is just trapped. And they're not smart. The average IQ of 85, and that means half the population below that, they can hardly function. And they're living, in squalor, and they don't have intact families. And it's just horrible. And yet,
Who produces the pop culture that promotes degeneracy?
Especially rap music.
Yeah.
I mean, that's all over now. And white teenagers are listening to it like crazy and relating to it and rapping themselves. And it's just, you turn on the television, you're likely to see blacks in every ad practically. And unless it's for a drug for old people, then they'll have a couple of old white people.
Yeah.
That's about it.
Well, the promotion of interracial dating, particularly black male and white female, that's all planned out. I mean, you can say, well, it doesn't matter. If it doesn't matter, why is it being promoted so much? Why is it being promoted so much? Because it's almost primal. I don't even think they have to defend it, but I have to. Is the idea that you want to defend the genetic traits of your people, and there's in-group preference, but then in-group preference is called, there was a President Sarkozy of France who I think a few years ago said it was the obligation for white women to have babies with black men.
Yeah, it's almost that way then. Absolutely. And you see so many ads now with white men and white women and black men. You don't see that many of the reverse, but you see some of those too. And like I said, you almost can't see an ad anymore on TV for fast food or whatever that doesn't have black people in it. It's just...
Well, that's a deliberate decision that was made.
Oh, absolutely.
That's not even denied. You have to overrepresent them, and now it's like there's been a purge. Of it, it's a completely misrepresentation. They do it at the expense of even peddling the whatever product they're trying to sell, right? I mean, it's like they turn people off to it. I've been in rooms of people of so-called normies who are now looking at it, going, "Oh, what's this?" People are taking notice of it. But they know they're uncomfortable expressing a discomfort with it.
Yeah.
You know,
it's the third rail here. I mean, people just avoid it, and to advertise as another Jewish specialty.
I think 5 of the 6 major global companies are Jewish owned, if the last time I checked. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And the sixth has to go along with it because it's probably ultimately controlled by BlackRock, which is Jewish.
Yeah, BlackRock is hugely important. And for the whole ESG initiative, where they have stock in a company and then they'll pressure them to do the social governance, equity, diversity program in their companies. And so if you're a company, you pretty much have to go along with that. And they do. And so corporate America is not on our side.
Tilo, you still there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Well, that's another thing is ESG and corporate governance, how we talk about the corruption of our political class, how they're bought off. They're either bribed, blackmailed, or brainwashed to kind of to do the interest of the Jewish elite. So our governmental structures, whether the representative bodies do not represent us because of they're co-opted. At the same time, you have the influence that corporations have in determining the course of our society. Meaning, ESG is environmental social governance. Right. Governance is different than government. And they're using their immense financial power to guide society in certain directions, whether it's sustainable energy or whether it's tolerance towards degeneracy, diversity, equity. And you have these governmental bodies. Who elected Larry Fink to decide anything? Just because he has more money than I do, his vote should matter more. But nevertheless, they're guiding these policies and it's all coordinated. And it's the problem is these corporations do exist. Technically, they're given special privilege on a part of it because corporate charters are a privilege that government grants. Mm-hmm. And so these corporations would not exist if not for the existence of the state. So they derive all certain benefits from being allowed to operate and make money in our society. So they have certain obligations to that society. Originally, corporate charters were limited, a certain amount of time, a specific mission. But now with corporate personhood and various Supreme Court decisions. I think was it the Santa Clara decision, 19th century, that established corporate personhood. But it creates effectively a psychopathic institution that has it's a legal fiction. A person that exists, a corporation is something that legally exists but really doesn't. But because of limited liability, it has no personal responsibility. So in essence, you've created an entity with little or no liability. So that's a psychopathic institution, and that's how they operate. And if those psychopath institutions are then possessed with Talmudic Jewish thinking, which Jewish financial power has facilitated, you have a big problem from the standpoint of a society, because who's really controlling the course of our civilization, our society? If they can manipulate media, commercials, determine who gets investment, who doesn't, whether or not people invest in fossil fuels or green energy. So it's a huge area of political power, which effectively has no accountability to the people.
That's right. And I saw today this, the FCC is adopting a new policy, a total equity inclusion and all that. They're going to go after internet companies that promote what they call discrimination of any kind. And, that's the power of the government. And the government's taken over by these people, the left, that's what you're going to have. And we see that with the total weaponization of the justice system. I mean, you just don't stand a chance. If they want to get you, they will get you. And you'll be hauled in front of a left-wing judge, and you'll have a jury that is certainly not on your side either. And that's the way it's going to be.
Yeah, lawyers from the SPLC are being appointed to the federal judiciary by the Biden administration.
Yeah.
And have you ever watched the questioning of, like, Senator Kennedy, some of these appointees? And they're
I haven't.
Well, it's entertaining because he just asks basic questions of law and they don't know the answer.
Oh, yeah.
They're ignoramuses, but they're Janice.
Oh, I see. Yeah, the Senator Kennedy from Louisiana. Yeah, that was hilarious.
I mean, they don't know. I mean, literally, basic law 101 questions of constitutional law.
Doesn't matter.
Because it doesn't matter.
But their heart is on the right side, you see.
Yes, they're for justice. They're for racial justice and equity, and that's what matters.
Yeah, that's what matters.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the Southern Poverty Law Center is, of course, a Jewish operation.
Yeah, it started out that way, and some of them got purged because of the sexual scandal. But
yeah, Modi's,
still,
yeah,
it's still funded by Jews, and always has been.
And of course, Mark Potok was one of the main guys who famously had that interview where he had that sheet of paper in the background. He was charting the decline of white America.
That's what they want. That's what they want. They hate white America.
Now, promoting mass immigration into the country, non-white immigration in the country, have to do with fighting poverty in the South?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and have they really done anything to help Black people? Probably not. I mean, I don't think they have. It's mainly organized against white America. And,
Well, the question is how our society, certain precepts of society or presumptions that our society are based on aren't really true. I'm dealing with
presumptions.
You know, I kind of alluded to it earlier, is that if you have a society which is liberal, lets its guard down, allows a group as well organized as the organized Jewish community is, it's going to take over and become very illiberal within a generation or two, which evidently it has. I mean, it started out with the free speech movement. Then the moment they're in power, they act like commissars and they start suppressing free speech because it doesn't go the way they want. We see that right now with all the protests. You know, they've made universities sort of hotbeds of radicalism, of people of color. Then the golems react, and they just react by trying to shut everything down. You know,
that is one of the big stories. In the 1950s, they were hugely in favor of free speech because you had Jewish professors that were being forced to sign loyalty oaths. They were communists. Hall in front of McCarthy and everything, and now it's changed where free speech is anathema to these people.
And you have to sign a loyalty oath to Israel, effectively.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, did you watch the any bit of the Republican debates? It's everything. Who can do more for Israel? Who can love Israel more?
I mean, I did not watch Republican debates, but I'm no surprise.
That's all it is, a pledging to support Israel. You have Governor DeSantis, who went to Israel to sign a law suppressing free speech in his state, Florida.
Yeah. So, the first cabinet meeting he had was in Israel.
What was all that about?
As soon as he got sworn into office, the first cabinet meeting he had was over in Israel.
Yeah.
He was just completely nutcase pro-Israel. He's just a typical American politician. He wants to get elected, and he knows how to, you got to do that. If you want to be taken seriously, and certainly RFK Jr. is not that way. They don't see him as a friend.
No.
So.
But even he has to toe the line when it comes to
he's very pro-Israel.
Yeah, they said Israel, has a right to exist, and as E. Michael Jones said, that's funny because the Jews didn't think his uncle had a right to exist. He's alluding to obviously it's controversial, but there's a lot of evidence that Israel was one of the many entities that were involved in the Kennedy assassination, John F. Kennedy.
Yeah, I've heard that. Yeah.
And so that's a whole other topic. But the idea is, again, but I know we have a few more minutes here. I just want to the second article you wrote, of course, was will this current crisis lead to Jews losing the moral high ground? They've had the moral high ground because they've been able to sort of create the narrative where their history's victims, they're the perennial victims, and now they're coming across obviously here as they're the ones with saturation bombing, killing civilians, and it's hard to maintain that narrative when you have the feed coming with people, thousands of babies being murdered, being entombed in rubble because of the Israeli bombs.
I think it's a real problem for them because, as you say, historically, they have portrayed themselves as victims. I'm just reading these academic things about how Jews think about themselves. And, Jewish suffering is a big part of Jewish identity. And so they have, they think of the Holocaust first and foremost. But, going way back in history, that Jews have always been persecuted for no reason at all, irrational anti-Semitism. I wrote a book on anti-Semitism, and my conclusion was that all the big outbursts of anti-Semitism have been very rational. They've had to do with, you know, oppression, really. As I said, the Jews often made alliances with these oppressive elites, like kings in the aristocracy, and they were fleecing the common people and that sort of thing. And so it's Jews have, in a sense, never been victims. They've been far more often exploiters than victims. And but that's the portrayal that they have. And it's a constant barrage. I mean, how many Holocaust films have they made? Hundreds. And it just never ends.
I think it was Chaim Weizmann, I think the first president of Israel, who said that anti-Semitism is a perfectly rational response to Jewish behavior.
Yeah. I think Theodor Herzl invented, you know, the main promoter of Zionism, 1890. He said that. Mm-hmm. He said, these are real interests. We can't get rid of it. We have to have our own state. But of course, you know, they have their own state, but they certainly the diaspora hasn't gone away. And it serves a very important function, because when you control the United States, have big influence in the United States, shall we say, that's important for Israel.
Yeah, as early as 1910, Jewish community was able to cancel a trade agreement with the Russian government.
In the Taft administration. And this was before, where the Jewish power was nowhere near what it is now. But again, it was based on all these lies and exaggerations about how Russia was oppressing the Jews and all that. Andrew Joyce has written a number of very good articles on the pogroms, so-called pogroms and everything, in the 1880s going up to 1905 and later. And they've been put out stories about mass rapes and murders and everything, and it was just false.
You know? Either the Russian government ever, like Cossacks behead 40 babies.
The tough spot. The Russian government was in a tough spot because Jews were oppressing the peasants. They'd just been freed from serfdom and everything, and they were getting exploited right and left. There's a lot of hatred there. And also Jews were very upper limbo. They were dominating, you know, university admissions and that sort of thing. And the government felt they had to do something.
Yeah, and they migrated west because there's this explosion of Jewish population. There's only so many middlemen positions that they had to head west to Germany.
They overshot their niche. There were a lot of poor Jews in Eastern Europe. Their economic niche was just overcrowded. They had huge numbers of children. This was the real ultra-Orthodox Hasidic Jews, which we see in Israel now. They have huge numbers of children. And they were putting out children, and huge population increase in the 19th century. And that has had tremendous effects on the world in the 20th century and beyond. It's massively important.
Yeah, the influx, I think 1880s, 1890s in the United States, and it wasn't too long before a cohort of them had gotten very privileged positions in finance and the burgeoning entertainment, Hollywood. There was there was a police commissioner in New York. I think his name was Thomas Bingaman, I think was his name. This was like 1906 or 8. And he was writing about the high crime rate among the Jewish immigrants. And he was forced to resign for writing that. Again, this is like long.
Truth doesn't matter.
Yeah. Even though it was true. Yeah. So. But there we go. So you will see if they might have gone too far. Chutzpah has historically been their downfall. They don't know limits, so they push it and push it and push it. We're seeing that.
That's the aggression thing I was talking about.
Yeah, and it's Jewish cultural aggression, which leads to the reaction. And people talk about the forces of reaction. They call they call some like Nazis a reactionary phenomenon. Well, what were they reacting to? I mean, to really understand that whole period of history, you have to talk about the action that led to the reactions. We have a full understanding, but they don't.
You have to talk about communism, Jewish involvement in communism.
Yeah. Although they'll talk about Kristallnacht.
Oh yeah.
But wasn't there an assassination just before, how does Kristallnacht compare to like Black Lives Matter and the 2020 riots?
Right.
You know, you can blame a lot on George Soros and Jewish money for promoting. Mm-hmm. Just saying. So, yeah. So it's very interesting to see if they, if this particular period, or I'm sorry, this particular outbreak of war in Gaza will lead to anything, into a change regarding how people understand Jewish power. Because now it's kind of out there for all to see. It's obvious.
Who could deny it now?
Yeah. You know,
you'd have to be completely blind. And I do see some liberals who are shocked by what's going on over there. But, you know, they can't have an honest discussion about Jewish power in general. And they don't even talk about, you know, AIPAC or anything. You know, all they do is talk about, oh, what's going on in Gaza, a completely divorced from America. But it's not divorced from America. You know, we are critical to Israel's success at this point. And they just, politicians and media,
which makes us complicit in their crimes.
Complicit. And as I said in the article, this war and Jewish behavior to the Palestinians is going to be a huge problem for American foreign policy. How are you going to convince other countries in Africa, Asia, and all that, that, you know, America is all for human rights and the Western culture is all for human rights? When you see that, I mean, it's not just America, but it's also Western Europe going all in for Israel. And, you know, so the whole talk about human rights just rings hollow at that point, where you just can't justify what's happened here and is happening now.
Doesn't just expose just how corrupted or co-opted the political class is when you see almost uniform reaction on the, I mean, in France, they're passing a law, the Senate passed a law making it illegal to criticize Israel.
Yeah. Well, in this country, all these red states, I guess, have adopted these laws against the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement.
Yeah, 35 states, last time I saw it. 35 states.
It's incredible. And it's obviously against free speech and free market principles and that sort of thing. Doesn't matter. They can square the circle on that, and they will. It's another example.
Yep. So, well, I said I had you for an hour. I think we covered it, don't you think? The two
articles. Yeah, that's good show. Good article.
So, well, I want to thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah.
Great. I'll post this soon. I'll send you the link. Is there anything you want to promote?
Oh, well, you know, I talked about Oxford Observer and Oxford Quarterly. Mm-hmm. My website is kevinmcdonald.net. I have all links to all my books and some chapters and all my writings and everything. So you might look at that. If Google allows you to go there, I don't know. Sometimes they don't.
Yeah. Choose another browser, or a search engine, Google, by the way, owned by and policed by the ADL. ADL commissars, making sure they keep everything safe and nice over there. So, well, Dr. McDonald, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Enjoy.
Listen, you have a happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you.
Take care. Bye-bye.